This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan MacLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm in Sandton today for what I know is going to be a very interesting discussion. I'm chatting to Marius Raitz, country manager at cryptocurrency exchange Luno. Marius, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Duncan.
So Luno's been a pioneer, certainly in the South African context, in the cryptocurrency space. Who's behind the company and how did it get its start?
So our co-founders are Marcus Swanepoel. Marcus is an ex-investment banker. Timothy Stranix. Timothy is an ex-Google engineer. He worked on Google Maps in Switzerland. Carl van Wyk. Carl is a software engineer. And then also Peter Hines. Peter Hines is a chartered accountant. So the four of them co-founded Luno, or better known, or back in the day, better known as BitX. The company initially had a B2B focus. Before BitX, the company was called Switchless. Switchless had a B2B focus, and Switchless built the first fully integrated Bitcoin system for a major multinational bank. We then realized that banks were moving too slow, and we decided to move our focus to the B2C market. We then launched BitX. BitX then focused on our consumer wallet. So that allowed consumers in South Africa for the first time to buy cryptocurrencies.
So you were the first cryptocurrency exchange in the country?
Yes.
All right. How did these four guys get, how did they meet in the first place?
That's a question you should probably ask Marcus and Timothy. They had mutual connections through FireID in Stellenbosch. Marcus spent some time in Silicon Valley. He's very enthusiastic around new and emerging technologies. Timothy obviously has a tech and engineering background. And Peter and Carl also worked in a Stellenbosch startup region. The four of them got together, all four of them having finance or tech backgrounds, and all of them really fell in love with this idea of Bitcoin and the potential that it has and can have in the global financial landscape. So I think that drew them together, this mutual common interest in tech and finance.
Were they all originally from Stellenbosch, Cape Town area?
Yes, so Peter is from Namibia.
Oh, Namibia, okay.
Yes, Marcus is from South Africa, Carl is South Africa, and then Timothy is from Durban.
Durban,
yes.
Okay, yeah. My hometown. So, Maurice, you've been with the business now for about 3 years. How did you get involved?
I'm a management accountant, so I joined Luno early 2016 as a financial analyst, joined the finance team. But at the time, I think we were 8 or 10 people in the business. So as with startup companies, you get stuck in most parts of the business. So even though I joined as a finance analyst, I helped across different teams from compliance to operations to customer support. My role then evolved from finance analyst to payments manager. So I moved to the operations team, worked closely with banks to find the best solutions for our customers to deposit rand or fiat money into the Luno wallets to make that experience more seamless. So I worked with banks across the world in South Africa and Nigeria. I also unofficially managed our Nigerian business, so did frequent trips to Nigeria, to Lagos, to Abuja, to build out our business in Nigeria.
And how much interest was there up there as a matter of interest?
Yeah, so we launched the company, soft launched the business there towards the end of 2015. Unfortunately, our initial volumes were driven by Triple M and Ponzi activity.
Oh, really?
Yes. Since the Ponzi activity sort of subsided, we saw real growth and people buying cryptocurrency for the right reasons. Greed, I suppose you can argue whether that's the right reason, but for investment purposes, and our research also now showed that 83% of our consumers are currently using cryptocurrency for investments. So we've had steady growth in Nigeria. Some months we're seeing more interest in Nigeria than South Africa, to be honest. And also, Nigeria quite often ranks highest on the Google search stats for Bitcoin. So we've seen good growth in Nigeria.
And all that Ponzi scheme activity that's out of the works, is it?
Yes. So again, comes back to the educational side. We need to play a very important, or we're playing a very important role in Nigeria from an education perspective. Training people on how to identify these schemes and how to protect themselves from this. So it's still a challenge. It's not limited to South Africa and Nigeria only. It's a worldwide challenge. It's one of our responsibilities as a player in this industry to warn customers and to keep all the bad actors out. Mm.
So you worked your way up through the Luna organization. When did you become country manager?
So from payments manager, because I've been working with our South African bank partners, with the SA Reserve Bank, 13 felt it was a natural move for me, maybe perhaps to then more officially take over the South African country responsibilities. So the decision was made back earlier this year in February, March, and then I officially moved over to country manager June, July this year. Mm.
Yes. And you're a Cape Town boy, are you?
Cape Town boy, yes.
Okay. But you're now in the big city, I suppose Cape Town's a city too, but you're now in Joburg. What prompted the move?
Yes, I made the move from Cape Town to Johannesburg the end of September. Duncan, I think it was just a good opportunity for me from a personal growth perspective, and also it's a great opportunity for Luna itself to grow our business in South Africa and across Africa. So our Johannesburg office will be home to a new engineering team. So we're trying to tap into the talent pool up in Johannesburg or in Gauteng. And also the Johannesburg office will also be our African headquarters. So it's just easier for us to commute and get access to other African markets straight from Johannesburg. And then, of course, there's a big, thriving cryptocurrency community in Johannesburg. Lots of events. Regulators are all based in Johannesburg. So from a business perspective and from a perspective of launching our business to South Africans, Johannesburg made sense. Up until now, we've relied on organic growth to some extent and the rising Bitcoin price. But we're now in the next stage of growth where we actively have to market our business and our brand and build a trusted brand in South Africa.
So who sits in the Cape Town office now?
So the Cape Town office is our mothership. It's not our head office, though. So our head office is in London. Cape Town is our mothership. So we have currently almost 150 people working in our Cape Town office. And that's all your traditional team. So it's operations unit. Our engineering team, I think we have close to 50 engineers in Cape Town, finance teams, compliance, marketing, quite a few of those traditional roles, and they support our global operations. So they provide support to our African, European, and our Southeast Asian businesses.
Mm-hmm. When did the head office move to London?
So the head office was initially in Singapore.
I remember that. What was the connection there?
Singapore connection.
Yes.
So Marcus worked in Singapore for most part of his career, and he was based in Singapore at the time of formation. So
I see.
So yeah, he's a world traveler, but he had residency, he had his home in Singapore. So we decided to move it there, and also because we launched in Southeast Asia, so it's also it's close proximity to those markets. Yes, and then we launched across Europe. During 2017, and the decision was made to move our office to London. London is the fintech hub of the world currently. Lots of interest, lots of new technologies and startups establishing themselves in London. Mm-hmm. So that was the main driver for London.
And you've attracted some big name investors over the years, haven't you? Naspers is a backer of Luna, right?
Yes. Yeah. So our investors range from DCG, it's a cryptocurrency investment company in New York, and then Naspers, of course. Very fortunate to have them backing us. Naspers did our Series A investment round in 2015. And then last year, September, we announced a Series B investment round, and that was led by Bulletin Capital in the UK, and also Rand Merchant Investments. So we're very fortunate to have these backers supporting our business, not only from a financial perspective, but also to help us launch our products in different markets from a localization perspective. And yeah, it's just a comfort to know that you have these heavyweights being available for support and yeah.
Yeah. Are you working this business towards a listing at some point?
Well, that's a question you should ask Marcus.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think I can't say yes or when, but yeah. I think most aspiring companies or most companies aspire to that point, to that IPO point, right?
So,
well, I think we're still very early stage. We're still a startup business, so it's too early to venture into that territory, but. We are certainly building a global business, and we believe that we can become a billion-dollar business in the next couple of years.
So how many markets are you operating in around the world now? You mentioned Europe. You mentioned your expansion into Africa. You're in Southeast Asia. Do you know off the top of your head how many markets you're actually in?
Roughly 40.
About 40.
40
okay.
markets. So in Africa, we fully launched in South Africa, Nigeria. We announced our intention to expand across 20 new African markets over the next 12 months. So that'll push our African presence up to 20 markets, more or less. Southeast Asia, we launched originally in Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. So we're active across those three markets. We're also looking to expand across Southeast Asia. And then in Europe, we launched into 35 countries. So luckily, Europe can be seen as one business because of
the euro
and exchange controls making it easier for people to move money between different countries. So all in all, we're launched in 40 countries, but of course emerging markets, that's where it all started, and that's still where we're seeing the most growth.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Okay, I was wondering if the North American market is of interest at some point.
That's a challenging environment and high barriers to entry at this stage. You have companies like Coinbase dominating that market. You have regulations. We are pro-regulation, but licensing and regulations making it difficult for you just to enter the market. You will have to spend considerable amount of resources and money on launching your product there, and then you're up against a company completely dominating the market. So it would have to make sense from a business perspective to launch there. Yes, I mean, our goal is to become the global powerhouse or the dominant player on a global scale. So at some point, we would have to make a leap and venture into that market. But for now, our focus is on expanding our footprint in Africa and Southeast Asia.
You mentioned regulation. It's always an interesting one in this space. You're going into emerging markets in Africa where I imagine there is a lot of exchange control in place. What are some of the regulatory barriers you come up against? Do you have to go into every single market that you want to launch in and have conversations with the central bank, with regulators before you can launch?
Yes, I would say yes. So it's not an easy feat to launch in Africa. So our approach is to set up fully fledged entities in each of those countries, and to provide the fiat on ramp in each of those markets. So we don't follow the P2P approach that would make it more easily for us to launch in certain regions. So our first phase would be to incorporate entities and then to form partnerships with local banks, right? So that's the biggest barrier to entry at this stage for us, access to bank partners. Most bank partners take guidance from central banks. So for us, the hard work is in engaging with central banks. And luckily, we've been doing that since our founding back in 2013. So it's nothing new to us, but certainly is a barrier to entry. And it is necessary for us to launch our exchange or our platform in those countries. So, yeah.
So you're spending lots of time on an aeroplane then?
So luckily, Peter Nairn, one of the founders, he's heading up this.
He's doing this.
The country
okay.
expansion project.
Yeah.
But we're drawing resources from quite a different number of teams. It's not a one-man effort, certainly. And we're also depending on local knowledge on the ground. Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is something I'm quite interested in. Luna started with Bitcoin and then you expanded into offering Ethereum. Why only those two?
Yeah, that is probably the most asked question we get. So to us, at this point, it's more a business decision. So there's a couple of reasons. So the first one is customer security. So it's, we've published this on our blog, and we've commented on this a couple of times, but we have a certain checklist or criteria that needs to be met before we will consider listing a coin on our exchange. That would include the use case of that coin. It would include the level of adoption, liquidity in the market, security, who are the founding team or the developers behind that coin, and the list goes on and on. But now I would say that, listen, you have coins like Litecoin and Ripple, for example, mm-hmm. and they have sufficient traction. Why are you not listing those coins? To us at this point, listing multiple or more coins on our exchange will increase the complexity significantly. We're focusing on the consumer market in South Africa. We're marketing our consumer wallet. And if you're trying to explain cryptocurrency or Bitcoin to the layperson on the street, now you're confronting them with a whole array of different coins, mm-hmm. and they now have to decide which one to invest in. So it's not only the customers, but also internally we have to get ourselves from a customer support perspective to provide world-class support for each of those coins, right? So that's another consideration. And I mean, I think thirdly also from business perspective, you have to make trade-offs sometimes between listing off new coins or adding a new security feature to your products. So we feel at this stage that we want to perfect our current offering first with Bitcoin and Ethereum. We want to get our consumer wallet and our exchange and our offering in general up to a certain standard before we will consider adding more coins. I'm not saying we won't ever add new coins. We certainly open to adding new coins. It's just the timing of when we will do that. We can add multiple coins in a short space of time. We've built the infrastructure to handle that, but as I just explained, from a complexity perspective and from a confusion perspective to the end consumer, that's very important. And also, adding a new coin shouldn't only have a marginal impact to only a handful of customers, right? So, if you're adding a new coin to your platform, it must serve the majority of your customer base. So, we listen to our customers, and if we feel that there's a big enough demand for a specific coin, then we will seriously consider that.
What are your customers saying, though? I mean, when you get these requests for additional coins, which coin is dominating as a third option?
I think currently, I think it would be Ripple or XRP.
All right.
And then you also get Litecoin. And then you get people coming from the left, launching their own coins, wanting you to list their coins. But yeah, so I would say Ripple, Bitcoin Cash, and Litecoin probably.
Interesting. Yeah. Of course, Monero's lead maintainer is a South African, Ricardo Spagni. Not much demand for Monero, or do you hear calls for that as well?
Well, you should ask this question to Rick, to Fluffy Pony.
Yes.
I think there's an increasing demand for privacy coins, and
yes.
We had Rick at the January Action event in Sandton 15 October, and he took the audience through the different use cases or why there's a need for privacy coins. And I certainly think that there is an appetite for privacy coins in South Africa and a demand. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Perhaps we all some down the line list Monero on our exchange. But
for those listening to this podcast, can you maybe take us through what the difference is between a privacy coin like Monero and something like Bitcoin, which is pseudonymous? What does that actually mean?
So I think in lay terms, and I'm not on that technical level, but Bitcoin is known as being pseudo-anonymous. So you can't attach an identity of the person to that specific coin, but you can, through the blockchain, identify a Bitcoin address, and you can identify the person or the address that holds or the address to where the money was moved to.
So in other words, if you're determined enough as a police investigator, for example, you can probably trace where that transaction came from.
Exactly. And we have software now that can pick up trends. So, for example, if you send crypto Bitcoin to a Bitcoin address that's listed on or that's sitting on Bitstamp or any of the big exchanges, the technology would be able to identify that transaction went to a Bitstamp Bitcoin address, for example.
Right.
So yes, from a law enforcement perspective, it helps us, but you still can't link someone's ID number or someone's name to that Bitcoin address. So that's why Studio Anonymous. So from a Monero perspective, it's completely anonymous. So you can't, like in the case of Bitcoin, trace the Monero transaction through software like Chainalysis or Elliptic and identify the location where that coin was seen. So I think that's probably the biggest difference between the two. Yeah.
So I'm interested, what's happened to trading volumes and demand this year? We obviously saw the peak of Bitcoin in December last year, around about $20,000, and since then Bitcoin and other cryptos have tumbled, and then in the last few months Bitcoin has kind of gone into a bit of a holding pattern. It's kind of hovering around the $6,000 or $7,000 level. Has that led to less interest amongst consumers?
Duncan, I don't think so. And I think our results show it now that there's still a level of interest in South Africa. So of the respondents who participated in this research study that we undertook, 83% of them indicated, 69% of them indicated that they have some level of familiarity with Bitcoin.
This was a research study that was done by Kantar TNS on behalf of Luno.
Yes, so we commissioned Kantar TNS to do research around the level of adoption in South Africa. So they did a cross section of the population. They took people from different age groups, different genders, income groups, different parts of the country, and the results revealed that 69% of people showed some level of familiarity with Bitcoin and Ethereum or cryptocurrency in general.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting also is that 29% of respondents indicated that they have owned Bitcoin before or that they currently own cryptocurrency. So that to us is really encouraging. I think it's a testament to the fact that Bitcoin is in its 10th year currently or 9th year it's been here for 10 years, and I think it's safe to say that it's not just going away overnight, and that reaching a point we have traction in the market. So to answer your question, yes, we did see a drop in volumes. I think it was to be expected. The December price was driven by, or the December volumes was completely driven by greed, increase in price, complete irrational behavior. And the price stabilized considerably, and since February and March this year we've seen a stable Bitcoin price moving between the 1900 and 10,000 rand band. So yes, volumes on our exchange did drop. So December we saw, certain days up to 1,000 Bitcoin being traded on the exchange, and currently we're seeing trading volumes, and it's publicly available. People can go onto our website, onto our exchange, and view the volumes. But currently we're seeing between 250 and 600 Bitcoins being traded per day. So it's still sufficient volume. If you convert that to Rand or to dollars, you'd still
it's
be
a big number.
It's still a big number. But I think the positive or more important is that it's becoming easier for people to buy cryptocurrency. So we're seeing improved infrastructure. We're seeing more exchanges offering the consumers the option and offering consumers a safe option to buy cryptocurrency. We're seeing increase in awareness. So through the study that we conducted, we saw that people are quite aware. They might not be that on a technical level that aware of exactly what the risks are, what the potential is, but they've heard of it, right? We're seeing less biased media. We're seeing more pragmatic regulators. We're seeing more use cases evolving. We're seeing institutional interest. So I think there are quite a few macroeconomic factors that's pointing to the fact that we're on an upwards curve.
Why do you think the banks don't offer the ability to buy cryptocurrencies?
One word, regulation.
Oh, they're not allowed to?
Yeah, so Bitcoin is an unregulated, not sure if you want to call it currency or an asset, but it's an unregulated store of value. And like I just mentioned, our biggest challenge across Africa is access to bank partners, and that is because banks are being guided by central banks. So they're not allowed, and same counts for financial institutions, for stockbrokers. They're not allowed to actively trade or offer this to their customers.
Mm. Yeah. So with the decline in the value of Bitcoin this year and the relative stability we've seen in the last few months, are people buying and selling cryptocurrencies for different reasons now than they did in the past? Back in December, it was pure speculation, right? Yes. People were mortgaging their houses to buy this asset because they thought they were missing out on the biggest boom in history, and then it all collapsed. Mm-hmm. Do you find that people are buying Bitcoin today for different reasons than they were a year ago?
I think so, yes. I think the bubble burst in December, January, so I think most of the greediness subsided to some extent, even though it will still exist. But I think the most prominent use cases for investing currently is day traders. So you have people trading on a daily basis, trading between different exchanges, so doing arbitrage between price differences or taking advantage of price differences between different exchanges. Then you're also seeing more sophisticated investors, people putting on a monthly basis, putting away X amount of money, buying for the long term.
Would with a unit trust, for example.
Yes, exactly. But again, it's obviously high risk unit. So the keyword here is responsibly. So don't invest more than you can afford to lose. You know, all the normal advice that your financial advisor would give you. But yeah, and currently we're seeing traders, and we're seeing day traders, customers trading on the exchange on a daily basis, and then also investors.
Mm. Yes. All right. Interesting. Will Bitcoin, in your view, ever be widely accepted as a means for payment? And if not, is that a problem?
So I think yes, it will. We have still a long road to go in terms of adoption. Yes, the Bitcoin price stabilized to some extent, but in comparison to fiat currencies, it's still volatile. It's still more volatile if you convert the up and downs into percentages, you would still see a lot of volatility. So, yes. So for any currency or for any trusted means of exchange to get a high level of adoption, you need stability, right? And that counts for the ZIM dollar, or it counts for the rand, or for any other currency. So currently that's the biggest issue. People are not willing to use cryptocurrency because of volatility, but also because we're not having enough people, enough merchants accepting cryptocurrency. So yes, we have, we're seeing traction from a merchant integration perspective. So if you look at on the enterprise side, more companies come to the fore trying to do integrations with e-commerce websites and with merchants to accept Bitcoin. We saw Pick and Pay towards the end of, I think actually early this year, doing trials, doing a pilot with Bitcoin. So, and they worked with Electrum and also with Luno, and customers added a slip printed out of the tool with a QR code, and the consumer could scan the QR code to pay for their groceries. And they successfully tested that for a week or so. So we know that Bitcoin can be used as a means of payment. And we of course had the scaling issues towards the end of last year. We saw high level of high congestion on the network that led to slower transaction times and that led to high network fees. Since then, we've seen the Lightning Network being introduced and being worked on. We've seen transactions becoming cheaper. I paid for transport the other day. I think it was 1,000 rand, and I paid like about 80 cents for that transaction. So it's becoming a lot cheaper. Transactions are being settled sooner. So yes, I think we're already reaching a point where the technology has scaled to some extent. We're reaching a point where we're seeing an increase in adoption, so more people are willing to accept Bitcoin. From a Luno perspective, we're seeing more businesses opening Luno accounts, wanting to pay their suppliers, wanting to receive payment in Bitcoin. So I think we're on an upward trajectory on a payments perspective. Our research results revealed that 35% of respondents indicated that they either use cryptocurrency for e-commerce payments locally or cross-border. So
I presume it's the people who already hold cryptocurrency.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So paying for your goods on a US online store, for example, because you're not able to use your credit card.
Right.
Or people who've been victim to identity theft. So they don't trust the website to enter the credit card details, for example.
Does Bitcoin solve anything, though, in day-to-day transactions? For example, if I go and buy my groceries at Pick and Pay, is there any compelling reason why I should consider using Bitcoin over, say, paying with my credit card?
Well, for one, if you manage your money through a Bitcoin wallet, I think over time you would pay less bank fees, less transaction fees. Also, the value of Bitcoin being limited in supply actually is deflationary. So you would technically get more value per unit over a longer period of time.
So I'd probably want to hold on to it rather than use it for transactions.
Well, that's the other point. And also from an ease of use perspective. So instead of taking out your credit card and swiping your card and typing in a PIN, you take out your smartphone, you have control over your finances in the palm of your hand, and you scan a QR code. Much similar to SnapScan, actually. So it's a significant better user experience from our perspective. Over the long term, as the technology scales and continues to evolve, you should be able to do free or near free transactions. And then also the speed of transactions, and then not just locally but globally. And I know there's the question of exchange controls, but just the ease of use to buy something on a foreign e-commerce platform, or to pay for your flights in the UK, or to send money for business purposes overseas to settle outstanding invoices. It's just the ease of use, speed of the transaction, and also the cost involved that's significantly better or lower.
So has the Lightning Network resolved the problems?
Well, I think it has to some extent. We're seeing more Lightning nodes being activated or being enabled. Of course, that will lead to cheap or free transactions. So that's, again, network effects. The more Lightning codes being enabled, the more useful it will become. Mm-hmm. The more use the people can derive from it. But at this stage, I think all these problems that we've just identified in terms of scaling, it's being worked on in a global, coordinated way. We have some of the world's smartest developers and tech specialists working on this together.
I think my next question I need to make clear is asking for your opinion rather than Luno's take on it. But what do you make of the current price of Bitcoin? Where does it go from here?
So from Luno's perspective, we don't speculate on the price. But from a personal perspective, and of course don't want to give financial advice,
of course,
in any of that. But I think from personal perspective, I value the price, or I value Bitcoin in terms of its future, in terms of its potential use, right? So we know that Bitcoin, or I know that Bitcoin, or I personally feel that Bitcoin is the answer to the future. Bitcoin will transform the way we think about money. It's already done that. We're seeing people thinking about money differently than they have previously. We're seeing a change in consumer needs. That's ever changing. People are demanding more efficient money. And we're seeing this technology in Bitcoin that will enable people, or that will enable us to meet this increasing demand, or to meet this demand of more efficient money. So I think, and the research results showed that we're seeing increasing interest, especially across emerging markets. So from an adoption perspective, from an interest perspective, we're seeing increase there. We're seeing interest on a global level from venture capital firms. We're seeing increase from institutional companies. We're seeing ETFs being considered. So there's really a lot of traction in the market. And personally, I believe this is just the beginning. I believe over the next 5 to 10 years, people will willingly start using cryptocurrency. At this stage, it's very much bridging the old and the new, and that's the role that Luno is playing currently. But people will willingly start to use cryptocurrency for payments, opposed to just trying it out for the interest or for interest's sake. And I think when we reach that point, we will start to see massive network effects, and I think the price of Bitcoin will definitely reflect the the use for it.
Mm. Yeah. I'm sure you're aware of the Gartner hype cycle curve. It's actually quite uncanny if you look at that line that they draw in the Gartner hype cycle and how it almost matches the price of Bitcoin over the last 3 years. Do you think we're in what Gartner now calls the trough of disillusionment before the I think they call it the slope of enlightenment?
Well, I think so. I think there's a lot of confusion in the market. A lot of people thought that, or a lot of people think that Bitcoin is dead. It was quite enlightening this week. We did a couple of TV interviews this week and radio interviews, and in each of the studios that we entered, and also the hosts of the talk shows, they were quite surprised to see that they had Bitcoin on their script, or Luna on their script. So I think there's still a lot of confusion in the market. A lot of people still think it's a scam. But then you also have the believers and the people driving this technology in South Africa, and that's a subsection of the media. You have the stakeholders like Luno, and then we have a thriving crypto community in South Africa. So I think yes, we are currently in that phase of the Gartner up cycle, but through a collective effort by all the different stakeholders, I think over the next 5 years, I think we're currently still in the bridging the gap phase, and we will probably be for the next 3 years. So I think we will remain in this trough of disillusionment for the next 2 to 3 years still. But I think once we're through that stage, once we move into the second stage where, like I said, people start to willingly use cryptocurrency, I think that's where we will start to see real growth and use.
When do you see mass adoption happening? How far out?
Well, it's obviously it's a guess, but I think we're still probably 10 years out.
Okay.
Minimum.
So I've got no doubt that there'll be people listening to this podcast who have not bought cryptocurrency before. And I'm sure that there are many people who have bought cryptocurrency before and have been burnt who are listening to this podcast. What should people do and not do when buying, say, Bitcoin? What are some of the basic rules? Obviously, you mentioned earlier on, don't invest more than you can, so don't be silly and mortgage your house. But what are some of the basic things people should be considering? Should they be buying Bitcoin, for example, as their first cryptocurrency?
Yeah, good question. I think first of all, people should go and do research. They should first understand the technology, or they should first have an idea of what they're dealing with, or what they are about to buy into. So there are lots of resources online, also on the Luno Learning Portal. I think it's really important, not only from a financial, from a risk perspective in terms of potential losses, but also from a security perspective. So before buying cryptocurrency, you should have a good idea of how to secure your account, or mm-hmm. which safeguards to put in place to secure your account. So I think the first step is research before you enter the market. Familiarize yourself with the technology, with the risks involved. And then I would encourage people to start off small. So I would encourage people to start off with 50, 100 rand, buy your first cryptocurrency, whether that's Bitcoin or Ethereum. I think for the layperson on the street, the first time that people being introduced to cryptocurrency for the first time, I would think that Bitcoin would be potentially the safest option. It has the biggest market cap. It's been around for the longest time. It has sufficient liquidity at this stage. With as we discussed earlier, with more or less a stable price. So I would tell people to go and sign up with a trusted provider. Again, do your research, identify the founders behind the business, identify the entity behind the business. You should be able to read up on them in local media. Do your homework around the provider, and then start off small. Deposit a couple hundred rand or 20 or 50 rand. Try out the product. So first, you must first trust the provider before you can actually go on and deposit more rands or start using it more frequently. So that would be my advice. Start small. Have a conservative outlook initially. Our research also revealed that 48% of people mentioned the risk of losing money as the biggest fear. And that's the risk of making errors. So whether you buy Bitcoin or Ethereum, you need to know how to, if you want to use payments, how to send Bitcoin or Ethereum to another party. And also security risk, right? So the risk of being hacked, the risk of being phished. So there are things like two-factor authentication and strong, unique passwords, checking the URL of the website that you're about to log into. And then also 47% of consumers cited the need for a trusted exchange, right? So again, as I said, do your research, and once you're comfortable with that, then go on, deposit some money and play around with it.
Let's talk a bit about security, because you've touched on it. We've seen headlines over the last, I think it's been going on for years. Occasionally, you see, a couple of times a year, maybe you see a headline saying $50 million hacked from some international exchange in Japan or Korea. What is actually happening there? Is someone breaching their infrastructure and stealing bitcoins off their system?
So we have operators or exchanges operating in the global space with no regard to customer security and customer safety. So that's the protection of customers' personal information. That's the safeguarding of customer assets. And that's why we're seeing these acts. We're seeing exchanges being hacked. The security controls or being breached, and unfortunately that's happening with a handful of exchanges across the world, a handful of exchanges not being responsible and having zero regard for consumer security and consumer safety. So that's what we're seeing. Of course, you will see the media reaction. You will see. I won't say it's biased media reporting, because it did happen and it's important to point it out. But I think the majority, I think as I said, now with little research, you should be able to find an exchange that you can trust you can trust with your money. But also worth pointing out that this is a new technology, right? And like any new technology, there are risks involved. And as much as it's the exchange provider's obligation to protect or safeguard your funds, you as a consumer also have an obligation to safeguard and protect and put measures in place to control the access to your account. So as I said earlier, two-factor authentication, using strong, unique passwords, not using the same password on multiple websites, checking the URL of the website before you enter, and then also things like not falling prey to requests to enter your login details or bank details through an email. So banks or any financial institution won't ever ask you to enter your personal bank account details or login details. Or whenever email you is telling you that your account will be suspended in 2 hours if you don't click on this link. So people need to be vigilant for things like that.
What is a hard wallet, and at what point should a person who's buying cryptocurrencies consider getting one?
So weirdly, no, we store customer funds in escrow. So the control over the private keys sits with Luno. So we store customer private keys. We store it offline, so it cannot be hacked. It can only be hacked by physical brute force, and someone would need to hack multiple bank vaults across multiple continents simultaneously, and then decrypt the private keys. It would probably result in a world war or something. But that's to the extent people would have to go to.
But if it's offline in a bank vault, how do you operate an exchange if you've got those keys?
So we also operate what's called a hot wallet. So that's a float that we use to process data transactions. So a tiny percentage of total customer holdings sits in a hot wallet that's online. But we also implement control measures around that. So we've partnered with BitGo, and they co-sign each transaction before it gets sent out.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a second layer of security. So if Luno gets hacked, the hackers won't be able to send the cryptocurrency, or that most likely won't be able to do that, because we still have our co-signing partner in BitGo, and they have to approve of each transaction before it gets sent out. So then you get a hardware wallet. So to some extent, similar concept of the one where Luno stores your cryptocurrency offline, your private keys offline, but in this case, you own your own private key, whereas Luno's control over your private key in other instances.
So if you're paranoid and you really don't trust any exchange, then you'd get a hardware wallet and you'd keep these keys yourself. Okay.
That's exactly.
Understand. Great. Before I let you go, Marius, where do you see Luno in South Africa going over the next few years?
So, Duncan, Luno's vision is and has always been to upgrade the world to a new financial system. So we're not busy building a gambling company where people can speculate and trade and make their money in short space of time and become rich. We're currently in the process of trying to change mindsets, trying to educate people about money, what money is, and the fact that because we've been using money in the way that we currently are, that doesn't mean that we need to use money the same way going forward. We're trying to get this change in mindset, get this message across that the people of today, the modern world, demand more efficiencies, and that through cryptocurrency, we now have a technology or a tool that will enable money to catch up with other advances we've seen. And people quite often refer to the way that the communication system evolved from more recently landline phones to internet smartphones, right? So to us at this point, operating an exchange is just a means to an end. It's to introduce people to cryptocurrency, to educate them about cryptocurrency, about the risks and the potential it has. But to us, and as more use cases emerge over the next couple of years, I think we'll have a better idea of exactly what products we will build or we will change our product. But at this stage, it's an on-ramp for people. It's bridging the old and the new and upgrading people to cryptocurrency.
Marius Reitz is South Africa Country Manager at Luno. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central.
Thanks, Duncan.